From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, in 2022, 53 migrants are found dead in the back of a trailer. New details about that deadly journey are coming forward.
Many families and for many communities in Central America and in Mexico, traveling to the United States is a rite of passage. It's an economic necessity. It's something that people undertake knowing the risks.
And he was called the Desert Killer. Now David Leonard Wood is facing execution, but there are questions about his guilt.
It's one of those tough cases that raises an amount of doubt, and people sort of have to decide what amount of doubt they're comfortable with as the execution approaches.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On June 27, 2022, a tractor-trailer pulled up to the Border Patrol checkpoint at I-35. It looked like most any other 18-wheeler, and the Border Patrol agents waved it through without looking inside. Had they inspected that rig, they would have found 66 migrants who were in the country without authorization, and the Border Patrol could have saved 53 lives. Because later, on that very hot day, when the trailer reached San Antonio, the passengers from Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras had succumbed to the extreme heat and lack of ventilation. The driver did not try to save his human cargo. He parked that trailer near Lackland Air Force Base, and he ran. This event is considered the deadliest human smuggling attempt in U.S. history. Journalist Elliot Woods investigated the victims and traveled to Mexico and Central America to speak to their families. His story, A Deadly Passage, is in the March issue of Texas Monthly.
The story was obviously horrifying to me, as it was to most people who saw the news, I'm sure, when it happened. But the reason this incident really stood out to me is because I had read this book by Jorge Ramos years ago called Dying to Cross, or Morir en el Intento. And it was about a very similar tragedy that had happened in Victoria, Texas, a long time ago. And when I saw the news of this incident, I started just looking around and looking for other similar incidents. And I realized that this was the most awful migrant disaster related to the trucking industry in U.S. history, as far as we know. And it was the most awful, the highest death count in a migrant disaster of all types, as far as we know, also to include people getting lost in the desert. But these things happen on smaller scales all the time. And the more I started looking into it, the more I saw that the number of people who are dying in the attempt to cross into the United States has been going up by substantial amounts in recent years. And so my interest in this story was to raise the fact that crossing the U.S. border is a deadly endeavor, and it's getting more deadly by the day, and that there was something about this incident that I thought we needed to understand beyond the numbers of the dead. I felt like there was a much bigger story here that I needed to look into.
Yet when you went to talk to the family members who lost their loved ones in this tragic event, you heard that there's still a willingness to take on these types of journeys, despite the fact that they are very well acquainted with the risk.
No doubt about that. And I chalk that up to the fact that for many families and for many communities in Central America and in Mexico, traveling to the United States is a rite of passage. It's an economic necessity. It's something that people undertake knowing the risks, because the alternatives are so bad, or because there's so little opportunity at home. This is the immigration system that has evolved over the decades in the absence of an immigration system that actually recognizes the demand for labor here on the U.S. side of the border, and the need to create guest worker or temporary visa programs that actually match up to the demand of labor and the supply coming from the other side. You know, the US generates millions and millions of jobs for undocumented workers every year. I think the number is probably more than 7 million on average in recent years. And we have a temporary visa system that affords about 65,000 seasonal temporary visas. So it's very clear that the US economy is benefiting from and using undocumented labor consistently over time in numbers that are exponentially larger than what the visa system allows for. And that's created an economy that's reflected on the other side of the border that's dependent on remittances from people working in the United States. And so we're seeing this all over the world right now. And so it's hard to imagine that people whose communities have experienced something as devastating and tragic as what happened in San Antonio in 2022 would be willing to consider migrating north, but they are. And to me, that's not particularly surprising. People take extraordinary risks to put food on the table all over the world all the time. And this is just another form of that.
When I used to report in Mexico, I frequently would meet, you know, adult males, and I would tell them I'm from San Antonio, and almost all of them would have a story to tell that they had been here because they, as young men, had made that journey. A lot of them came through San Antonio. When they got here, they felt like they had arrived and they were able to begin the second part of their experience. But, you know, they would come here, they would work, they would raise their stake, and then they would go back to Mexico, and then they would be able to buy a cab or something and begin the other part of their journey. But, you know, we had a system that actually kind of worked until we hardened the border.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and that gets to the nature of the word migration and migrant work. When I was speaking to these families down in Guatemala and Mexico, I asked all of them, did the person who traveled north, who you lost, did they intend to stay in the United States forever, or were they intending to go for a while, make the money that they planned to make, and then return home? And every single family told me my loved one planned to return home. They were going to make money. They wanted to save up to build a house, or they wanted to save up to buy more land, or they wanted to save up to buy a car or something like that. They had a goal. Like you said, they wanted to raise a stake and then they planned to come home. And one of the unintended consequences of hardening of the border since the mid-1990s has been that people who would otherwise come for a season, if they're working in agriculture, perhaps they'd come for the harvest season, maybe move around the country following different harvests and then go home. People who would come for a short time to raise that stake that you mentioned and then go home are now thinking, well, I better stay for a couple of years. I better stay for 2 or 3 or 4 or even 5 years because it's so dangerous and so expensive to cross the border. And the stakes are so high crossing the border that I can't afford to do it every year. And I need to maximize what I'm able to do while I'm here before I go home. So the hardened border actually traps people in the United States and prevents the migrant flow, the back and forth migrant flow that would otherwise occur. And then that has devastating consequences on the other side of the border, where families are deprived of the person that's here, whether that's a father or a mother or anyone who's important to that family back home. That person is isolated here. The families are broken apart by this system. And the ultimate beneficiaries of the system the way it is are people who depend on non-citizen labor that doesn't enjoy the labor protections that citizen laborers enjoy, and then the smuggling industry and the various contractors who profit off of the construction of the hardened border. But, you know, the estimates for the current value of human smuggling on the U.S. southern border range from about 7 to 13 billion, according to what I was able to find during my reporting. So yes, there's clearly a problem here that could be addressed by policy And the failure to address that problem is hurting people, it's killing people, and it's facilitating the growth of organized crime.
So you're looking at the June 27th, 2022 tragic smuggling incident that happened here in San Antonio, the death of 53 migrants. This was a huge story, covered in all the major media, a lot of follow-up coverage. What has changed since then? Has there been a policy or something that has adapted to prevent this from happening again?
I don't think so. The biggest change since then is that in the late months of the Biden administration decided to restrict the asylum pathway and decided to also focus on hardening the border. And the Trump administration is doubling down on that in every way possible. And so, one thing that people see in the media is there's a tendency to evaluate what we now call the border crisis based on the metric of encounters with migrants at the border, which is when Border Patrol encounters someone or catches someone. And for years, many of those encounters, and in some cases hundreds of thousands per month, have been people who are intentionally crossing the border and then turning themselves into a Border Patrol agent as soon as possible, because their intention is to pursue the asylum pathway. And they're not trying to enter deeper into the United States covertly to hide as an undocumented person. They're intentionally putting themselves into the asylum pathway. Well, now that asylum pathway is effectively closed. So this is just my opinion, but what the data show is that hardening the border over the years has not had a significant effect on the number of undocumented people who actually live in the United States. It does have an effect on how and where and how many people are encountered by Border Patrol. So what we know from the data is that when there's a hardening of the border at a specific location, people move to another location. And often that location is more dangerous, more difficult, more risky, more expensive, et cetera. So I would expect that we may see a temporary decline in the number of people who are attempting to cross. I don't know, but that over the long term, the consequence of further hardening of the border will simply be that people continue to look for more risky and dangerous ways to cross, to the benefit of the human smuggling networks that are waiting to profit from all of this, and that we can expect more deadly incidents like the kind that happened in June 2002 and like the kind that have happened so many times in recent decades.
But you described that the people who were in this truck trailer who died, that they, in your reporting, they wanted to come here to raise the stakes so they could build a house, buy a car, buy more land. And then that they knew that the risk, and the family knows the risk, and that they could die. And yet you're saying more people will continue to come. But is that really why they're coming? Is that really why they're willing to risk their lives? I mean, it seems like there needs to be something more to put yourself in a tractor trailer like that, or some of these cross through these deserts on foot to risk your life. I mean, your life doesn't depend on buying more land or getting a new car.
Well, in some cases it does. I mean, for example, some of the families that I spoke to in Guatemala, they were earning about $2 a day or less trying to work on the local labor market in Guatemala. And if they're working in the agricultural sector, which most of the families that I spoke to were working in agriculture, they're confronting all of the effects of climate change in an area of the world that's very sensitive to climate change, from prolonged severe droughts to hurricanes to the expansion of novel diseases and crops and blights and pests and that sort of thing. And so it's a place where children often go to work in violation of Guatemalan law, at 12 or 13 years old to help their families. It's a place where people confront all sorts of risks to go to work every single day. And, you know, there's also a component of not thinking that it's going to happen to you. I mean, I'm a military veteran. I served in the war in Iraq and I lost friends there. But when we first shipped out, I don't think anybody in my company thought that we were going to be the ones who got hurt. And it's a different situation. But I think that when you go to places like rural Mexico and rural Guatemala, and you see the effect of remittances on those local economies, you see haves and have-nots that are related to who has somebody in the United States and who doesn't. And the people who have somebody in the United States, for example, in rural Western Guatemala, might have a multi-story house with a pretty new pickup truck parked in front and glass windows and a big wrought iron gate around it. And probably if you were to go in that house, they'd have food in the pantry and a lot less concern about what their income was going to be for the next month and whether they were going to be able to provide for their children and their families. And right next to that house could be a concrete block, one story dwelling with no door and no windows and a dirt floor where somebody has to quit school at age 12 to go work as a day laborer in the cornfields pulling weeds or travel on the coffee circuit in the summertime with no prospect of any advancement at any point in their life. I mean, human beings have taken extraordinary risks in search of better opportunity throughout human history. You could almost say that is one of the definitions of human history. So it's not surprising to me that people are willing to risk what they're risking to get to the United States for the opportunities that are presented here. It is surprising to me, on the contrary, that we maintain an immigration system that's so ignorant of the economic inequalities on both sides of the border and the legal systems that make these risks necessary in order for people to get where they're trying to go.
In your investigation into this tractor trailer, what did you find about them? Were there gang members?
Well, I have no knowledge about what crimes they might have been accused of in the past. At least four of them were Mexican nationals. Two of the people who were hyped as the kind of ringleaders or masterminds at the beginning, a guy named Christian Martinez and a guy named Omero Zamorano, were U.S. citizens born in the U.S. Both of them have pleaded guilty. And currently, of the seven people who were arrested in connection with the case, there are only two who are going to face trial starting Monday of next week, March 3rd. The only thing we know about any of them is what's been put out through the Department of Justice press releases. The Homeland Security investigations material is all under seal until the trial is over. But this is just my opinion based on reading the indictments and the DOJ press releases and looking into some of these guys' backgrounds. They seem pretty low level to me. And, Homero Zamorano has a long rap sheet that you can see. It's publicly available in Texas. And he has spent some time in and out of jail for petty crimes, theft and petty assault and various other things. But Christian Martinez had no criminal record that I know of prior to this incident. And they seem like pretty small time players to me. But obviously they're wrapped up in an international human smuggling network that is nebulous and vast and extremely profitable. But it will be very interesting to see what comes out of the trial in terms of understanding how that smuggling network works and how these people on this side of the border played into it. So another thing that is interesting to me is that there were seven people arrested in Guatemala last year in connection to this incident as part of this international Homeland Security investigations operation with the Department of Justice, Task Force Alpha, it's called. But there hasn't, to my knowledge, been anyone arrested on the other side of the Mexican border in connection to this incident. So I think that the suspects who are going to trial on Monday and the people who've already pleaded guilty in relation to this incident here in the United States do not really represent the breadth of the human smuggling operation that connected people all the way from rural Honduras and Guatemala all the way to the border.
Elliot Woods is an award-winning journalist. This article was produced in collaboration with the Food and Environment Reporting Network, an independent nonprofit news organization. Work on this story was also supported by the journalism nonprofit, the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. His story, A Deadly Passage, is in the March issue of Texas Monthly. David Leonard Wood is due to be executed by the state of Texas on March 13th. Wood is also known as the Desert Killer. He was convicted of being a serial killer and a rapist who killed at least six girls and women in El Paso in 1987. Wood has insisted on his innocence, and there is a lack of physical evidence that ties him directly to the deaths. Wood's defenders say the prosecution only was able to convict Wood and sentence him to death using questionable jailhouse snitches. Maurice Chaumont has written about the case for the Marshall Project. His article is, "He Refused to Become a Jailhouse Snitch. Can He Stop David Wood's Execution?"
Sure. So David Wood was sentenced to death in 1992 for a string of murders of six young women and girls as young as 13. But he's maintained his innocence for the entire time. And in the last 10 or so years, his lawyers have managed to find a lot of evidence that really kind of cast doubt on the conviction. You know, the state obviously maintained certainty that it got the right man, but some of these new findings raise questions. And probably the most sort of compelling anecdote from this investigation they've done is into a man named George Hall, who called them up last fall and basically said, "I was asked to lie and fabricate testimony against David Wood, and I refused to do that, but I saw as two different men fabricated testimony against him." These were all men who were incarcerated together at a prison in East Texas, and this fellow, George Hall, basically says, these two guys who are on the cell block with us, they took deals as, you know, jailhouse informants, sometimes known as jailhouse snitches, to testify against David Wood and claim that he confessed to these murders, and that in exchange for making up these things and telling a jury, they got reward money and lighter sentences. So that's the claim. And that is, this story is one of a handful of sort of big claims that are front and center in a sort of a last ditch petition that David Wood, through his lawyers, is making at the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals and eventually federal courts as well.
So there does seem to be evidence and some eyewitness testimony that does point towards David Wood. But still, the prosecutors leaned into this jailhouse snitch testimony. And that seems to be the focus of what you're writing about. It is well known that Texas frequently uses jailhouse snitches, and they are completely and totally unreliable because they do have a motivation to lie. And as I understand it, one of the jailhouse snitches said that David Wood told him that there were 15 murders there's no evidence to back that number up. It seemed like he was just making stuff up.
Yeah, I mean, their testimony is rife with red flags, and we know from a lot of other sort of known wrongful convictions that jailhouse snitches have these incentives to make things up and often sort of fly, basically will say whatever to convince a jury of their story. I think in this case, if that was the only thing, let me back up and say, we also found a memo that was circulated within the DA's office in El Paso back at the time in 1990 that said, basically, we don't have enough evidence to indict or convict David Wood. We need someone else to come forward and give us some more evidence, or otherwise this guy's going to walk. And it was at that moment, shortly thereafter, that these informants came forward, right? So there's this paper trail that suggests that they were fulfilling a particular need to kind of shore up what was otherwise a largely circumstantial case. The only real physical evidence in the case involves some carpet fibers that the lawyers have raised questions about that were found at one of these six crime scenes, not all six, just one of them, that matched some carpet fibers in a vacuum bag at David Wood's apartment.
They were the orange blanket fibers.
Yeah, that's right. These were blanket fibers that were at one crime scene, and then they were also purported to be in David Wood's truck. The defense has claimed that you can't really say that they're a match, and that the testimony, at the time claiming they were a direct match was suspect. This was at a much more kind of rudimentary time in forensics. The trial was in 1992. I should also say, perhaps one of the other biggest claim, other than this jailhouse informant that the defense is making, is that there remains quite a few items from these crime scenes that were never tested for DNA. And one item that was tested for DNA had a blood stain. It was a piece of clothing, and the blood stain matched an unknown male that was not David Wood. So the defense is saying this execution should be halted in order to do more DNA testing. Meanwhile, you, of course, have the victim families who have waited almost 40 years for an end to this case, who, at least the ones that I've talked to, very much want to see this execution carried out so that they can get a kind of finality and closure for it.
I had read that there was a woman, Judith Brown, who was abducted by David Wood. She says this, and that she had been taken out into the desert, and he was going to rape and murder her. He did rape her, and that managed to get away, and that she told the police, identified him, and that isn't why isn't that enough to consider this a open and shut case?
Yeah, absolutely. Judith Brown Kelling, her last name, she came forward and said, David Wood sexually assaulted me and took me into the desert and nearly killed me, but got scared by some sounds and ran off and left me there. The lawyers for David Wood have claimed in their new petition that at other times Judith Brown said that she was indeed sexually assaulted, but that the perpetrator was not David Wood. She gave a different name for the person. And the claim here seems to be that the police would have, in order to go after David Wood, would have sort of incentivized her, much like a jailhouse informant, to change the name of the person she claimed sexually assaulted her. This is all to say, that is another piece of kind of circumstantial evidence, claims about the sort of modus operandi of David Wood that would seem to connect him to all of these murders. It remains, however, a case where there's no sort of smoking gun in either direction. Both sides clearly have spent their time looking for it. And so it's one of those tough cases that raises an amount of doubt, and people sort of have to decide what amount of doubt they're comfortable with as the execution approaches.
Maurice Chamal is a journalist with the Marshall Project, and he's written, "He refused to become a jailhouse snitch. Can he stop David Wood's execution?" That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. We've got past episodes of Texas Matters on our website at tpr.org. And you can find us wherever you download cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.